Good evening, everybody. I wanted to, this week, discuss a new topic in Halacha, but Be'ezus Hashem, we'll get back to the topic of davening, and like many people asked, that we should discuss what the Halacha is of what exactly a woman's obligation to daven is, what's the story with Shabbat and Yontif, Maariv, Mincha, etc. So Be'ezus Hashem, we'll get back to that. But this week, I want to discuss something different. I wanted to talk about the halacha of your oven, how exactly you one is supposed to switch between when you use it for dairy, when you use it for meat, in what situation do you have to kasher it out, burn it out, how do you burn it out? So let's start to discuss that, and we'll see how far we get with this. So in order to understand the what's behind this and to know when you need to do something to the oven, when you have to burn it out, when you don't, we have to understand one basic concept in kashrus in general. And the concept is as follows. When we say that a pot or an oven or anything is dairy or it's fleishigs, it's meat, what we need to say is that being that it was you cooked something dairy in it. You made macaroni and cheese in this pot, or you cooked chicken soup in this pot. And now, even though it's 100% clean, but we say that the taste went out of the food and into the pot. And so much so that we say that the volume of the taste that went into the pot is as big as the pot itself. So in other words, we look at the pot as if it's one big piece of cheese or one big piece of meat, being that it was cooked, and you cooked meat into it, in it, and it got full of the taste of meat. And there, then the problem that happens after that is that when you cook something in that pot afterwards, so if you had a chicken soup pot, and then you were to make macaroni and cheese in the same pot, the problem is twofold. First of all, the chicken soup that was in the pot goes into the macaroni and cheese, making it trace. And likewise, the macaroni and cheese goes into the pot, making the pot tray. So you have a tray for food, and you have a tray for pot. So this is the idea behind kashrus in general, that we're worried about the taste that went into the pot, and cooking makes taste go into a pot, and likewise, cooking makes taste go out of a pot. However, this is an important point. There are two things that are necessary for taste to go in and out of a pot. Number one, it has to be yatzei ledes bei, which means it has to be hot and hot enough that you would burn your hand if you were to keep it in there for a while. It's not exactly clear what temperature that is. We start being machmer at, 120 or something like that. So in any case, once it's hot, then taste can go into the pot. But if it was not hot, if it was warm, even if it was very warm, but it was not hot, that will not cause a problem. That's number one. Number two is that the taste can only go in and out of a pot through food. If you put food in a pot, the taste of the food will go into the pot, and the taste from the pot will go into the food. But there is no way for taste to come out of a pot into another pot without food. Meaning to say, let's say you have two pots on the fire, right next to each other. One, you're making macaroni and cheese. One, you are making chicken soup. And the two pots are covered, and they're cooking. Each one is minding their own business. And then you shove one pot, and the two pots touch each other. They're sitting on the fire. They're bubbling away. One's chicken soup, one's macaroni and cheese. The two pots touch each other on the outside. No problem. Nothing happens. Why? Because all that happened was the two metal pots touch each other. Taste doesn't transfer from metal to metal. You need to have a food medium to make that transfer happen. So being that all that happened was that a metal pot touched another metal pot, no problem. You would even be technically allowed to do it l'chatchila. We just don't allow that by two pots on a fire because we're worried that it'll spritz, it'll drip into one another. But technically, you would even allow to touch it l'chatchila. And therefore, technically, again, we don't do this l'chatchila, but technically, were you to take a boiling hot pot of chicken soup and put it down on a regular milchiga counter, a dairy counter, nothing would happen. Because all that happened was the metal pot touch the countertop. No food there in between them. So nothing can come out of the countertop and nothing can come out of the pot, even though it's full of boiling hot chicken. Food taste only goes from food to pot and pot to food. It doesn't go from pot to pot or from pot to counter or from pot to anything else, only to the food and from the food. Now, once we understand that, so now we can begin to understand what's going on with an oven. When you have a tray of chicken, 9x13 of chicken in the oven, now, the 9x13 has the chicken in it. Now, is the chicken touching the oven? No, the 9x13 is touching the oven. So technically, how is your oven becoming fleshy to begin with? How is any meat taste transferring into your oven? The meat's not touching the oven. Only the 9x13 is touching the oven. That's like it's sitting on a counter. Should be no problem. Well, the answer is that it creates steam. And that steam we look at as if it's chicken soup. That's the way we look at the steam that comes out of broiling chicken is equivalent to chicken soup. So you close your oven, the chicken's uncovered, the steam fills up the oven, it's as if your oven just gets filled up with chicken soup. So that's why the taste gets into your oven. Now, once we understand that, so now we understand a couple of things. First of all, if your 9x13 is covered, so no steam escapes, even if a tiny bit escapes, we say that, and that's not significant. But if it's, you know, 99% covered, no problem. There's no steam. There's no way for any taste of chicken to get into your oven. Through the 9x13 itself, that's not a problem. There's no food medium. There's 9x13 touching the oven, no problem. That wouldn't be a problem. So if you were to have made chicken in your oven and it was covered, your oven is as parve before and after equally. There's no food and no taste got into your oven. And therefore, after you made such a chicken that was covered, you would be able to make cheesecake in that oven. Without a problem. Not only that, but again, technically, this is not advisable. You shouldn't do this. But if you want to make a cheesecake covered together with a chicken covered, you can do that. If you want to make a baked ziti in a 9x13, cover it with a piece of silver foil. If you want to make a chicken covered with a piece of silver foil, you can make them at the same time because no steam is getting out. And then there's no problem. Then there's no way for any fit taste to transfer from one to another. So now we understand what the problem is and when you have to worry about it and when you don't. So now we realize that there's a few options open to us when it comes to, we want to know, do you have to burn out your oven or don't you? So first of all, we have to know, did the oven become fleischig or dairy to begin with? Meaning, did you cook in this oven an uncovered chicken or did you cook in this oven an uncovered baked ziti, macaroni and cheese, or some other milk dish? Question number one. Now, assuming you did, now the question is, the new thing that you're planning on making, will that be covered or not? If it'll be covered, again, no problem. It can be covered and you can make it in there. You don't have to burn out the oven. The only time you'll have a problem is when you made a tray of chicken, the oven became fleischig. Now you want to make a tray of baked ziti uncovered. And if both of them were uncovered, then you have to burn out your oven. And because then you have a problem because they're both filling up the oven with steam. So that means it's as if you're filling up the oven with, first, chicken soup, and then where you to make the baked ziti, you're filling it up with cheese soup. So that you can't do, and that's why only in that situation you would have to kashrut it. With this, we understand one other point. There are certain foods that just don't give out steam. For example, challah, cookies. It's only something that has juice, and that juice bubble creates steam. But challah doesn't create steam. So if you made chicken in your oven, took it out, the oven cooled down, you then want to put in challah, you can put in challah. It will remain parve. There's no problem because the challah doesn't give off any steam. If it doesn't give off any steam, so then it's just sitting on its own 9x13, its own tray, minding its own business, and it's not touching the walls of the oven, and there's no medium for the taste that's in the walls of the oven to get into the challah. It's only when you fill up the oven with steam that any taste can come from the oven into whatever you're cooking in that oven. So to summarize, what we learned over here is as follows. We learned that the only time we have a problem with any taste getting into a pot or out of a pot is only through food. Food is the only thing that puts taste into a pot or takes taste out of a pot. Therefore, if you took a pot and you touched it to another pot, no problem. You took a pot, put it down on a counter, no problem. The food, there's no food in between them. It's just counter to pot, pat to pat, no problem. Likewise, you put something into your oven, it's covered, no problem. There's no food in that oven. Everything is covered. There's no steam. The problem only begins when you put something in the oven uncovered and it creates steam. Then that item which creates steam makes the oven, if it's a tray of chicken, it'll make it fleishig. And if it's something, a tray of ziti, it'll make the oven milchig. If you put one in after another, both uncovered, you have a problem. You need to burn it out. If you cover one of them, no problem. If you cover both of them, certainly no problem. And likewise, if one of them is a dry item which doesn't create steam, like challah or cookies, there's no problem at all to begin with. Now, you can't put challah in the oven at the same time that you're making uncovered chicken, because the chicken is creating steam, filling up the oven with this chicken soup, so to speak. And if your challah is there, it'll absorb that steam. So you can't make your challah at the same time you're making an uncovered chicken. But you can make it afterwards, because the challah doesn't give out any steam, so it won't extract any taste from the oven. So challah can be done without burning out your oven, and anything covered can be done without burning out your oven. And if you do need to burn out your oven, that we'll discuss in Yirtzeh Hashem in a future share. In this week's parasha, the Yaakov Avinu has finished running away from Laban, and now is notified of the fact that Esav is coming to attack him with 400 men. And he davens to Hashem, and he prepares himself for battle, and he also sends gifts to Esav. Then, as they're coming closer to Esav, they need to cross a river in the middle of the night, and Yaakov Avinu crosses his whole family and all his possessions, which were vast. Yaakov Avinu was a tremendous oisher, tremendously rich. He had livestock, he had slaves, he had shvachos, maids, and he had tons and tons of possessions. And he crossed them all over the river. And then he realized that he left something on the other side. Because I'll say, what did he leave on the other side? Pachim katanim. Small, insignificant bottles. So he went back to get them. When he goes back to get them, he's confronted by a person who Chazal tells us was a human form of Esav's malach, the one who's in charge of Esav's domain, so to speak. And they wrestle together until the morning. Yaakov Avinu prevails. And then in the morning, the malach says, now, time for me to go and say, Davin, give shiras HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yaakov Avinu forces him to give him a bracha. And then Yaakov Avinu is ready to face Esav. This story is bizarre on a number of points, and I want to focus on one nekuda of it, one point of it. And you wouldn't believe how much is written about this one point. It's farm and farm are full of this, and all across the spectrum, from pshat, remez, soid, Hanukkah is tied into this. And the point is this point that Yaakov Avinu went back for these small pachim katanim. Chazal say, we learn from here a very important lesson. But first let's consider what it is that Yaakov Avinu did. Yaakov Avinu, as we said, was, in our terms, a multimillionaire. He was Bill Gates of his time. They were so wealthy, Yaakov Avinu and Esav HaRasha, together, they could not live in the same country. It says that Esav had to go to Har Seir, Yaakov Avinu lived there at Tishrol. There was not enough room in the same country for them because their livestock was so vast. That's what Chazal say. So we can have an idea of how rich he was. Now, we know they once wrote, I remember about Bill Gates, that if Bill Gates walks on the street and sees a $100 bill, it's not worth his time for him to bend down and pick it up. Simply not worth his time. And here Yaakov Avinu goes back for Pachim Katanim. So the multi-millionaire, one of the richest people in the world, goes back for something which is equivalent to a couple of pennies. Bring to mind a story. I was in Chicago once for my brother's chasana, and there's a very wealthy person who my parents were staying by. His name is Yaakov Reichenbach. Mr. Reichenbach was himself very wealthy and a big boss of Tzedakah. And he was telling us a story how he was in a meeting with an older fellow, who owned 90 Hiltons. So one could imagine he was quite wealthy. And he said that some point during the meeting, they needed to take notes. So everybody pulled out a pen and started jotting down things. And this fellow pulled out a pencil. And the pencil was stubbed, so he started biting at it with his teeth to try to get some lead out of it so he could write. So one of the lawyers that there went over to Mr. Smith, let's call him, and said, Mr. Smith, why don't you have a pen? Could I get you a pen? So Mr. Smith said, you people have no respect for money. Do you realize how much money you save if you use a pencil instead of a pen? And he went on and on about it. So as crazy as that sounds, is this any different? Yaakov Avinu went back for Pachim Ketanim. It's basically the same thing. In relation to the wealth that Yaakov Avinu had, Pachim Ketanim were almost nothing, less than nothing. So Chazal really really remark on this, and they say, Tzadikim, chavivim aleihem, mamayinam yoisu megufam. Tzadikim, their money is beloved on them more than their goof, more than their bodies. And what that means is, in other words, more than their own tircha, more than their own effort, not the actual lives, obviously, but more than all the effort that they need to do, their money is more precious to them than that. Why? Then they add, m'nei shabon lehem shaloi begedah, because they get it without stealing. So Chazal obviously found this to be very interesting. Why would Yaakov Avinu knock himself out for this few dollars? And Chazal say, no, tzadikim chavivim aleihem mamayinam, their money is beloved on them. Now this sounds very strange. Tzadikim love money? Tzadikim don't love money. What do we know of our tzadikim? They didn't love money. If anything, it would seem to us they viewed money as a necessary evil. We all know the story with the Chafetz Chaim, how a rich person came to visit him, and he saw in the Chafetz Chaim's house he had no furniture. There wasn't even a single bench that wasn't broken. And he asked the Chafetz Chaim, why don't you have any furniture? Where's all your furniture? So the Chafetz Chaim said, where's all your furniture? So he said, well, I'm traveling. I don't need furniture when I'm traveling. So the Chafetz Chaim said, well, I'm also traveling. That's Ha'ilam HaZek HaProiz Darul, Shnei Ha'ilam HaBa, it's a passageway. So it seemed that our tzaddikim had no interest in money, and they viewed money as something which is, like I said, a necessary evil. So what then is the explanation of what's going on over here? But really, that's not really the Torah's approach to money. And that's not really the point of that story with the Chafetz Chaim either. What is the Torah's approach to money? The Torah's approach to money is that there's actually a few different points the Sfarim bring out about the Torah's approach to money, and I'll mention two of them, which we can combine into one. Number one, and this is really quoted from the Arizal, is that the tzaddikim see money as a present from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a bracha from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not only that, they view it as a pikadon, as something that was given to them for safekeeping. And therefore, it's their responsibility to watch it and to protect it and to do with it what Hashem wants them to do with it. And therefore, even on one dime, if they were not to give it the proper chashivos that it deserves, it's as if they are not appreciating what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them. That's what their result is. And obviously, to a tzaddik, on the level of Yaakov Avinu, this is to the extreme. And the second nekuda is like Chazal point out. The second point is Chazal point out that they get it without stealing. And what that means is that when tzaddikim work, and they give their time, and they earn money, and they go through the process of earning money, they're meiser nefesh, they give them their lives up not to steal, and not to be mazik, and to be 100% honest, and to avoid any averus. As we see in last week's parasha, Yaakov Avinu gave a whole long list, which we learn out many halachas of how a worker has to work honestly for his for his employer. So to them, the money is something they did a mitzvah with. It's a sefer shalom, it's like an asterisk. The money came to them without stealing, and therefore it's very precious. If we put the two reasons together, we could look at it as follows. We have a leichter. Every family owns a leichter. The candelabra that you light your Shabbos neres with, and it's very precious. Would anybody ever dream of, if you move and you went cross country and then you forgot your leichter behind, they'll say, oh, no, you know, forget it. Of course not. First of all, it's value, and also it's sentimental value, and it's important as something you've done a mitzvah with all these years. You've lit your Shabbos neres with it. Every dollar to Yaakov Avinu was a leichter. Every dollar was a present. It had sentimental value. It had chashivas for itself, and it was viewed as a vehicle to do Hashem's ratzon with it. And Yaakov Avinu, at the same time, when he realized that there was a mitzvah to be done, he would take every dollar he had to do that mitzvah. It says that when he wanted to buy his portion in Ma'aret HaMachpelah from Esav, he took every dime that he'd earned in by Lavan's house and piled it up all in front of Lavan and said, take everything, I want the Ma'aret HaMachpelah. Money didn't have an intrinsic value to him. Its value was the present that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it and what he can do with it. My brother is the principal of the staff of the Borough Park, and he told me a story right after he began, which really really shook us up. He said that there was one parent that had been paying full tuition year after year, and then one year they applied for a tuition break, and it was unusual because nothing seemed to have changed, and they didn't understand why it was that they just now started to apply for a tuition break. So they had a meeting, they called a meeting, and the parents explained to him that really, we really needed a tuition break for a couple of years. But we decided that tuition is more important than anything else. So we sold things to pay tuition. And last year we sold our leichter in order to pay tuition. And this year we don't have it. So now we need a tuition break. And this is in today's day and age, a couple of years ago. Postscript to the story is that the school made a dinner and they honored this couple. And guess what they gave them as a gift? They gave them a leichter. But this is Yaakov Avinu's understanding of money. It's as chashuv as a leichter. It needs to be treasured like your leichter. It needs to be treasured like your Shabbos candelabra. And it's as important, and it's important to Avodas Hashem, but at the same time, when it comes to using it for Avodas Hashem, use it right up. And what I think what's important about this is that we all struggle how to be mechanech our children the importance of money. And we have all the maxims, money doesn't grow on trees, and etc. And this is a very positive way to give over the message of what the importance of money is. Money is a gift. And Hashem gave it to us and wants us to watch it and wants us to use it for the right thing. And the question is, what is a necessity and what is not? And that's a discussion for itself. But money, for in and of itself, is something which we are very, very machshav. It's something which it represents a bracha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. And Yaakov Avinu demonstrated that to the extreme. Have a good night, and have a good Shabbos, everybody. Kol tov.